Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is your new Comic Book Day episode for November 11th, 2020. So Manny and I are going to be talking about a few of the books that hit stands today as you're listening to this that we've had a chance to read already. And then I'll give a rundown on some of the other books that you might want to be on the lookout for. So we're going to dive right into it. We're going to try to keep this kind of short and sweet. Manny and I are both pretty tired, so trying to get to sleep a lot earlier than I normally do after we record these episodes, since I gotta edit the sound and all that. So why don't you kick it off, Manny? What are you going to talk about first?
Kick it off with DC's Detective Comics 1030 by Peter J. Tomasi, Bleakis Evely on art, and then Matt Lopez on colors. And so this is kind of a, I like this. I like the fact that Detective kind of is going back to its own storylines that are a little bit different than the big overall Joker War that we saw. Although the Joker War wasn't necessarily my favorite thing, some of the things that are now spinning off of it are quite lovely, lack of better terms. We know that there's an anti-vigilante sentiment now that's really taking over the city of Gotham after what's happened, and so now vigilantes are being targeted. We've seen that in the couple of weeks past from other heroes who think they're saving somebody, but in fact they're actually being targeted for by these vigilantes, specifically that mirror guy who I don't remember his name right now off the top of my head.
The ghost?
I'm sorry?
You're talking about Ghostmaker?
Ghostmaker?
Ghost Walker? Ghost something.
He's not memorable yet, I guess.
I think it's Ghostmaker, yeah.
Ghostmaker?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, all right, well, if it's wrong, we apologize for now, but
I'll look it up right now.
Well, okay, we'll go with that. The first part of the story, though, does focus on Christopher Nanako, who was also running for mayor. Last we saw on his yacht, he was actually saved by Nightwing while Bruce Wayne was at the party, and it still didn't change his mind at all. We kind of see the idea of why. We see the some of the nightmares that he's going through. And then also we see that kind of the motivations of why he's running. He has a pregnant wife. Besides that, also there's also a couple of different separate storylines, which it almost feels like there's three different things going on, which Nanako, his bid for mayor, the Damian Wayne story that we saw that kicked off, where Damian had stolen Batman's black casebook and made sure that Batman knew about it in a very clear way. And then the third part of it also was the Bat family and trying to deal with how to deal with Ghostmaker and things like that. So, I mean, it's a lot of tension, a lot of good stuff. probably one of the most interesting moments in the book is as Batman's trying to analyze what Damian is doing, what he's going for. Is his reflection in his time with him, thinking that maybe he thought that Damian was better than he really was. It kind of made me think of me as a father. Is do I kind of overlook at some of the things maybe my daughter does because of how high in regard I hold her because she's my daughter? And Batman's kind of reflecting on the same thing. And then also he looks at the irony of Damian kind of refusing to be part of his dad's family, the Bat family, but at the same time leaving all these clues, kind of craving that attention from him. And how that, you know, opposites, but at the same time, that's what he wants. So that's going to be a really interesting thing to see what they do going ahead with that. Because, I mean, like, for example, Damian's not your favorite character. So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops and what really happens with that. The one thing I do not want to see is him show up, Damian show up with like Deathstroke or something, and it's like, oh yeah, I'm his mentor now or something like that. But that's kind of a long shot anyway. I do think that the whole vigilante thing is really, I like about it is that it really fits the times where you have different groups of people, different opinions, and it kind of follows what society's going through, and where what you consider the status quo isn't maybe necessarily what has been working. So it's time for a change, and you see the tension in the people, and that's why they follow this Ghostmaker, because they're realizing that the Batman and the family, as great as intentions as they've had, hasn't worked out. Joker still gets out. So does every other villain, and they're always in danger. And so now they're actually voicing their frustrations in a very violent way, physically to the people who they think are trying to help the city. So I'm really interested to see the narrative on this from Tomasi and how that develops and what kind of voice he gives to the people of Gotham in the upcoming issues.
Yeah, I kind of felt like this was really a transitional issue. There wasn't a whole lot of action. You know, you could say there was action in the beginning, but that was all a dream or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see. The whole anti-vigilante narrative, I'm like, really? We're going there again? And I get it. It's kind of topical to what's going on in the world right now with people being angry and stuff. But I don't know, man. I'm certainly not one of those that says, you know, no politics in comics, blah, blah, blah. They're always political because they reflect mm-hmm. society. You know, our society is political. And so comics are going to, but I don't know, man, maybe I'm just worn out and tired from all the craziness that's been going on. And so I could use a little less, in your face politics. As it were. But yeah, I mean, I'm still digging what Tomasi's doing. I thought Bilquis Evely was an interesting choice for Batman. I don't know that she's somebody that I would normally think of when you start talking about drawing superhero comics. I mean, I think her stuff works best in kind of over that Sandman universe, John Constantine, maybe a Justice League Dark. I don't know that she works that well on, I mean, the art's not bad by any stretch. It just, I personally don't feel that her style suits a, you know, Batman book. So,
no, I don't disagree with you. I do think that it helped that it kind of eased into it with that kind of dreamscape that Nanako was going through, and so that when it went into the actual real world of Gotham, it kind of made the transition a little bit easier. But yeah, it wasn't really what I would want out of a detective book. I do agree with you.
All right. Well, let me talk about my first book. Do I have any DC? I do, but you know what? I'm going to save that one. I'm going to talk about this book instead. Getting It Together, number two. So I didn't talk about number one when it came out, although it was pretty good. I think I talked about 14 books on that episode. So I didn't squeeze in Getting It Together. Number one, but it's from co-creators Sina Grace and Omar Spahi, art by Jenny Fine, colors by MX Strubel, letters by Sean Conant. And this is a slice of life book. And it's about a group of characters. Some of them are in a band, some are brother and sister, and it's very much about their relationships. And it's very much for mature readers. There's a lot of talk about intimate relationships, so, you know, sexual things and social media and the dynamics of relationships and where loyalties lie. So you could almost think of it as like a comic book version of a soap opera for the 2020s, if you will. It's very realistic, the way people talk, the way they interact, the way they relate to each other and the feelings they have. And you know, the worries and the anxieties that they have, and, you know, the pressures to try to succeed, and then, you know, they're trying to get their band off the ground and be noticed, and people are worried about their jobs, and, you know, it's really a very realistic and grounded book. There's a very diverse cast, many persons of color and sexual orientation. So it's just handled really, really well. You know, it's one of these kind of books that shows you that comics are so much more than superheroes. Like, if you have somebody that likes, you know, television shows where, I mean, I can't even really think of anything because I don't want, like, Melrose Place. I know that's like dating me, but I don't know what the modern equivalent of that is because I don't watch TV. But like, you know, sort of like a primetime drama show with a bunch of different characters, with really cool art, and it's a little bit stylized, but it suits it. This type of story they're trying to tell very well, and people are drawn very realistically. And like I said, there's same-sex relationships. There's just a real diverse cast, and it comes across as very metropolitan and very realistic. And you know, 2 issues in, I'm really enjoying it. I think that this is going to be I could easily see this being an award-winning book. So it's called Getting Together. I haven't heard a lot of people talking about it. I think it's sort of flying under the radar a little bit. But, you know, when you talk about things like Strangers in Paradise, you know, this is kind of the same sort of thing where you're really focusing on, you know, relationships, and it's not anybody with superpowers or any horror or, you know, kind of strange happenings. It's just, you know, a realistic look at people that are realistically reflecting the society that we currently live in, with different, you know, social problems and cultural problems and such. So I wanted to be sure, since I didn't get a chance to talk about issue 1, that I for sure mentioned issue 2. So what do you have up next, Manny?
I have Wonder Woman 766 by Mariko Tamaki, with art by Steve Puh, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr. And this issue really kind of takes it up a notch. We saw last issue that whatever Count Vertigo had released via his abilities, and also the Lord Industries psychic super tech that he got a hold of, really messed up Wonder Woman. She's blind, blinded by whatever this was. And so now it's up to her. Now she's actually being led by Maxwell Lord to figure out how to fight the soldiers of Count Vertigo and get the tech back. So it doesn't really work out that well. Because, kind of like we've been waiting forever, Maxwell Lord finally cuts ties with Diana and leaves her on her own. And that's as far as I think I can go in recapping what's going on in this issue. But I think it finally reached that level of pacing that I was looking for, as far as Maxwell Lord being the villain that we all knew he was. I really feel like it took 2 issues, maybe too long, especially that issue in Miami, of what that really almost felt like a filler issue. So I kind of like where it was headed. I do like, though, that they used Count Vertigo kind of as that transitional villain, where it was going to pose some problems, but not enough to really seem like the main villain in the story. So we're going to finally get that Wonder Woman Maxwell Lord confrontation or back and forth that we had been waiting for since actually the beginning of the Wonder Woman Tamaki run, so many issues ago. The artwork was okay. I thought the colors were pretty good, but It was a decent issue. It's a transition issue also, but a little bit more action. We see some of her abilities that she can conjure up based on some of our other senses. So good issue. A better issue on Wonder Woman that I've seen in a couple of months, actually.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was a better issue. I still can't. I mean, Steve Pugh's a good artist, but he's the wrong artist for this book, especially following Carlo Barbieri and especially following Mikhail Yanin. It doesn't work for me. So yeah, you're right. The reason this issue was so much better than the previous couple was all down to pacing. You know, it's the same creative team, but there weren't any wasted panels or any, you know, kind of filler. Because you're right, the last couple issues feel like that Miami issue should have been two pages. It should have really been two pages. The last two issues should have been squeezed into one because, it was a waste. So, all right, let me talk about my next book. It's from Marvel. It's Taskmaster number one. I've been waiting for this book for a long time. I'm a huge Taskmaster fan. And this was supposed to come out, I think, in May. Originally, but with the COVID and Marvel delaying their books, it got pushed back. So it's written by Jed McKay. Art is by Alessandro Vitti. The colors are by Guru EFX and the letters are by Joe Caramagna. And it's really good. I don't want to give away anything because spoiler free, but it's got a cool cover that's sort of inspired by New Mutants 87, that classic Cable cover. And it's Taskmaster, who is a mercenary, so he's not necessarily a villain, although I haven't ever seen him be an out-and-out hero. I mean, he's like I said, he's a mercenary. All he cares about is the dollar bills. But he is working with somebody here who you would consider a hero, or at least somebody who's on the side of angels or a good guy. So that dynamic between him and between Taskmaster and the other character is going to be really cool. Taskmaster's in sort of some trouble, and that gets explained throughout the issue. There's a lot of action, and the action scenes are handled really well by Alessandro Vitti. And I can't say too much more about it because, again, it's so action-packed and fast-paced that, and everything that happens is so like intrinsically tied to the plot of the story. And so I can't tell you guys too much about it because I don't want to spoil it. But what I will say is this. So the last time that I read something from Jed McKay, or last time I read a first issue from him, I think it was The Black Order. And I thought the first issue was really not very good at all. And I the only reason I gave issue two a chance is because I always say you got to give things two issues because first issues are so hard to write. And I didn't feel like Jed McKay did a very good job on Black Order number one. Like, it was really quite subpar, like a below average comic. But then I read issue two and he completely flipped it around. Like, he did such a great job. And so I was in on this because it's Taskmaster. And I don't follow Jed McKay's work. I mean, but he's not somebody who I think has no talent. I've read things from him before that are good. So, you know, I was hoping for something really good. And we got that in this first issue. So, you know, like kudos to Jeff for, or Jed rather, sorry, Jed McKay. Kudos to Jed for turning in such a great first issue because I know they're really hard to write and he's had some troubles with that in the past. So, I really enjoyed it. Highly recommend it if you're a fan of kind of that espionage and cloak and dagger sort of corner of the Marvel Universe with S.H.I.E.L.D. and, you know, spies and KGB and all that kind of stuff, because this is really going to be that kind of book where it's all about, you know, secret organizations and, you know, clandestine meetings. And it looks like it's going to be great because the setup is really cool. The action sequences are really great. I love the voice that Jed McKay gives to Taskmaster. He's giving him more dimension than I've seen a lot of people do. He's making them a little more real. He's got a little bit of a sense of humor and he's a little tongue in cheek and he doesn't take himself too seriously, which is always a risk with the Taskmaster because of just what he can do. You know, when you think about it, if you're not familiar with Taskmaster, he has what's called like photographic reflexes. So if he sees somebody do something, he can copy it like 100%. So if he watches Captain America fight, he can fight exactly like Captain America. If he watches Hawkeye use his bow, then he can use a bow just as well as Hawkeye. So when you think about that, you know, if he watches enough people, he can be, you know, as powerful as anybody. You know, granted the strength and you know, the healing factor, whatever, might not be there, but he is at the peak of physical condition and he can, you know, he has all these skills that he's gathered over the years by, you know, fighting against Daredevil and, you know, fighting against Spider-Man and all that kind of stuff. So really cool power, really interesting character. And the fact that this other hero comes along and sort of recruits Taskmaster makes a lot of sense at the end of the book. Like, you find out what their mission is and why he specifically needs Taskmaster, why he would go and ask Taskmaster or get Taskmaster's help. He doesn't necessarily ask him. But you know, you have to read it to find out, but it makes complete sense. It's a really cool part of the story that's thrown in there. So you can say, oh yeah, yeah, that's Taskmaster's exactly the person for this job. So we'll see how it all plays out. I think it's a 4-issue mini, and the next cover is teased in the back of the first issue, and it's showing Taskmaster and Hyperion from the Squadron Supreme. So really looking forward to the next issue. All right, Manny, what do you have up next?
Next up, I have American Vampire 1976, number 2. Written by Scott Snyder, art, cover art by Raphael Albuquerque, and colors by Dave McKeag. So I don't know if you remember the first issue I took. I was a little bit critical of it. And I don't know. I felt lost in it. And part two, The Stuff of Legends, was a complete 180. This issue was so good. It had a little bit of everything for me to kind of catch me up. I almost feel like this is something that they should have done in the first issue, but here we are. It's kind of like you. Also, I don't just judge a book by one issue. I'll give it two or three weeks to really make a decision on if I'm going to keep it or not. But the pacing of the book is phenomenal. It does a good job at kind of going back and kind of resetting who some of the characters are. It sets them up well to what they're going to be doing, which is Heist of the Freedom Train. And then also we kind of start seeing one of the antagonists, the Beast, and what their plan is for world domination in this issue, with some really big twists, actually. But I'm going to be real. It explained enough so well that by the end of the issue, I really felt caught up and engaged in the story and where it was going forward. So big kudos to Snyder for the way that he wrote this issue. Because now it really has me engaged and looking forward to the next issue. I am a big fan of Raphael Albuquerque's artwork. So I love those facial expressions and kind of the way he does wrinkles and stuff on faces really makes expression visible. And yeah, I mean, it caught me off guard because I wasn't necessarily too in on part one. But this book too, a complete 180, man. I loved it.
Yeah, I haven't read any American Vampire. One of these days I'm going to dive in. But today is not that day. all right, let me move on. So, trying to decide what I want to talk about. What are you going to talk about next?
Oh, again? My next book was going to... Huh?
You have two more, right?
Yeah, two more.
Okay. Are you going to talk about the death metal one next?
I was going to do Punchline next.
Okay, then I'm going to do Champions right now because it kind of leads into Punchline.
Oh, cool.
I feel it's sort of similar and even a little bit into the anti-vigilante stuff from Detective that we talked about. So I'm going to talk about Champions Outlawed number 2. It's from writer Eve L. Ewing. Art is by Simone DeMayo and Bob Quinn. Colors are by Federico Blee, and letters are by Clayton Cowles. So it seems like we're getting a lot of these sort of transitional issues this month with Detective and now Champions number 2, where there's not a whole lot of action. And it's kind of a setup, you know, like you get a big event or sort of a shocker in the first issue, at least with Champions, and now issue 2, sort of transitional, setting things up, and then issue 3 will be probably another big story beat. So we saw in issue 1 of Champions that some of them got captured, and this opens up with them being at this re-education site or whatever, and man, it just, like, right from the start, it puts a bad taste in my mouth. And I'm not saying that it's badly written, and it's paced well, and the art is really good. But again, and I know this is what I'm bringing to the book because of, you know, what's going on in the U.S. with the election and all that kind of stuff. But man, am I tired of the truth not being the truth, you know, and this whole thing, and I talked about this when I talked about the first issue of Champions and the whole law that was passed saying, you know, teens couldn't be out there using their powers because, you know, they're going to wreak havoc and hurt people and blah, blah, blah. And it's just not the case, you know? Like, there's a line in the first couple pages of this book where this instructor, I'm going to use that term as loosely as possible, at this re-education place says, she's asking these members of the Champions, these teens that have been captured, they're supposed to write an essay. And the prompt for their essay is, most teen superheroes unintentionally murder their loved ones. What can I personally learn from this? And I'm just like, and I understand that Eve Ewing's trying to be provocative and she's trying to make a point. But that is so disingenuous, right? I mean, first of all, no teen superhero is going to murder one of their loved ones. If they kill them unintentionally, that's not murder. Like, murder by definition requires intent. If you kill somebody with no forethought, even in a fit of rage, it's usually manslaughter, right? You didn't mean to kill them. So, you know, second degree murder is you meant to kill them without planning it ahead of time. First degree murder is like premeditated. You had a plan. You knew before you even went over there to be in the same place with them that you were going to kill them. So to say it this way, you know, teen superheroes unintentionally murder their loved ones, it's so disingenuous. It's such a lie. And I'm just kind of fed up with lies right now and with people questioning what facts and logic are. I'm just at my limit. And so you couple that with the fact that this story has been done before, which is what I talked about when I talked about Champions number 1. It was done with Civil War by Mark Miller in, what, 2005, I think it was. Man, I can't believe it's been 15 years. So anyway, I guess, you know, for people, for the next generation, this may be something new. But for me, who's read Civil War, that didn't work, you know, in terms of the ideas that for the Superhuman Registration Act, it just doesn't work. It's fascism, and fascism doesn't work. It's antithetical to who we are as human beings, right? We crave freedom and individuality and liberty. And as much as we crave those things, you know, there are laws. We're not free to just go out and do whatever we want. You have to function within the parameters of society, but you also can't be locked down. So it's always that balance between security, which is why we have laws, right? So we all know that we're safe, supposedly, when we go out of our homes. You can go down to the grocery store, you can drive down the street, you can cross the street, because there are laws. Cars have to stop at a red light and this and that. And so, you know, the laws are in place for all of our safety and our security. But you try to give, in a free society, you try to give as much freedom and liberty to people as you can to make their own choices and live their own lives and try to be happy. I mean, that's kind of the point of life. So when you talk about these sort of laws, like if you're a teen superhero, you know, you can't use your powers. Or in the case of Civil War, if you're a superhero, the government needs to know who you are, because if something goes wrong, the government's going to be the one to police the superheroes. I mean, there's so many things inherently wrong with that. First of all, there's plenty of nefarious, or could be plenty of nefarious people in the government that could get a hold of that information to blackmail you. The information could be not kept secure and the villains find out and your loved ones are hurt or held hostage or such. So all kinds of problems. It didn't work. I thought Civil War was actually a pretty good series and it explored all these ideas. So to have it be done again, like I said, when I was talking about Champions number one, been there, done that. I understand it's been 15 years, so maybe it's time to do it again, but we're doing it with kids this time. Again, super topical, very relevant. There's a scene in this book where we sort of get both sides, like the pro for the law and the con, what's bad about it. And so I appreciated that. But for me, it's not resonating for those reasons. I'm tired of, regardless of if it's for a story or not, or for a comic or not, I'm just tired of people being illogical and irrational. And like the facts are the facts. And that's just what it is. And all of a sudden in our society in 2020, and this really happened, you know, starting in 2015, all of a sudden the truth became subjective, which is just infuriating to me. I'm a very logical person, very scientific person in my thinking. And, you know, if you're going to come at me with, you know, telling me, hey, this happened, then I'm going to ask you for proof. Like, show me proof. And proof is not, oh, well, I read it on Facebook or I saw it on the internet. Like, it's got to be, you know, from a reputable source. It can't just be, oh, I saw it on Reddit. That's not proof. Anybody can go and write stuff on Facebook. Anybody can go and write stuff on Reddit. Like, give me actual empirical proof. So, and I know that's all subjective. As far as the book itself, in terms of how it's paced and how the characters interact, again, it's all done really well. I said this when I talked about Champions number one. I'm a big fan of Eve Ewing. I think she's a great writer. I like a lot of what she's doing. And I think she's very realistically portraying sort of the tough situation that these young heroes are finding themselves in. And they're all reacting to the situation and interacting with each other with that level of stress that the situation is causing. All that is portrayed very realistically. So there's a lot of value and merit to Champions and the storyline that she's telling. But I think for me, it's not a story that I'm interested in reading about right now. Like, maybe when it's over, maybe when the world calms down a little bit and it's not in such a crazy state, I might come back and pick it up again. But I think for now, I'm going to take a break from it. It's just not a story that I really want to read right now. Not that there's anything bad about it. I think the art is really great. And it's interesting, the kind of the stresses and the situation she's putting these young heroes into. And it'll be interesting for those that stick with it to kind of see if there's any long-term effects from this outlawed storyline that's running through the Marvel Universe. And the other thing about it is that, so it's being played out in Champions. There was an outlawed special, and then you've got the Miss Marvel series that's covering it and the Miles Morales series. But if you read any of the other Marvel books, you wouldn't know anything about this this Kamala Khan law, they're calling it, or Kamala's law, or Cradle, which is the organization that's been created to sort of police these teen superheroes. If you're reading Spider-Man, if you're reading Immortal Hulk, you wouldn't know anything about this. So it's certainly not an event that's on the scale like Civil War was. But I'm off of Champions for now. So, all right, Manny, you're up next.
All right, so kind of sticking with the same topical subject, we're going to go with Punchline number one by James Tynion IV and Sam Jones, with art by Mirka Adolfo, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr. So kind of the same subject that you're talking about with kind of being of the times, following the same narratives that we were seeing as far as opinionated people, kind of the brainwashing of people through social media, podcasts, and things of that nature. We now have a punchline. So in this book, this book takes place actually soon after the punchline's capture at the end of Joker War, and she's being put on trial for her part in everything that happened. What's interesting is that this book actually is taken from the view of Colin and Harper Row. Harper Row, we know, is Bluebird, and she, of course, is kind of the logical thinking of the two, while her brother Colin, it has been listening to a podcast that Punchline has put out in the meantime, kind of explaining herself on why she became so radicalized with the Joker, what her views are, what her motives are, and what happened to her. And throughout the issue, you kind of get to see some of those different podcasts and explain her new personality, why she is the way she is. Well, to kind of simplify a little bit, she really has PTSD after an encounter that she had while in school with the Joker. And luckily Batman was there to save the day, but those events really shaped her to what she became. And so we learn why she has the name Punchline and kind of what her goals are as a villain. I've seen some people even calling her a supervillain. That is not even close. So it's interesting because when I first read the book, I'm thinking, no, people aren't gullible enough to take her story and then all of a sudden take her side, despite of the fact of all of the things that she just did. Because her argument is, hey, I actually didn't kill anybody. I didn't do any of these things. I was there. I was kind of a commander or whatever. But I personally, I'm quote unquote a victim. I'm a Joker's victim. And with the way she describes herself, she actually gains a following. And I'm thinking like that doesn't work. That's crazy. And I kind of paused for a second and really thought about I'm not going to name names or anything in particular, but started thinking about some of the followings that are happening in real life. And no, it's not that it's not that crazy. Especially thinking of the anti-vigilante movement that is going on in Gotham, and watch, people are on edge. People are looking for that kind of group to latch onto, a lot of anti-probably government sentiment. So they're looking at Punchline as also a victim, and now they're on her side. And it's very much of what's going on today in society. And it's different than what I had expected this book to lean towards. And so I'm not exactly sure how I feel with it, but I will say that my biggest problem with this, not the story, because like I said, I really liked the way this book was put together. Maybe I also kind of feel the same way, that, you know, I'm kind of done with so much politics. I also agree that, I mean, for the longest time, I mean, what, Captain America 1, what is he doing? He's punching Hitler. We've seen Wonder Woman also in action. And it does follow, you know, current politics. We've seen that in history. But I think this year more than ever, I did want a little bit more distance between my comic book and my reality, which, you know, whatever. I get it. It's a platform. You can use it. And it's actually great storytelling. My biggest problem with this is Punchline herself. The way that she is made to really, really be anchored, latched on to the Joker. Because without the Joker, who really is she if she doesn't have that quote unquote message to deliver? What's her purpose? What is her what is her motives, rather other than just being at this point kind of a Joker follower, a goon? I mean, she's supposed to be the anti Harley Quinn, and I just don't feel like she comes even close to that level. Of course, a lot of it has to do with the amazing job that Jimmy Palmiotti, Amanda Connor did with the character to kind of give her own voice. And we've seen how much she's blown up and, you know, even being called a fourth pillar to the DC universe. But at this point, I just don't, she's just a Joker follower. She doesn't really have any, I'll call it street cred, I guess. and for the amount of time and effort that they're spending on her and kind of pushing her to be this villain, I just don't see it. She's literally just a Joker follower.
So I'm going to be the last one to defend somebody who's derivative of the Joker normally, but I will disagree with you a little bit. I don't know that she certainly hasn't gotten there. But that was the one thing about the book that I did find interesting, and I do find interesting about Punchline as a character, is that Harley Quinn was always in service to the Joker. But even, I mean, when you talk about this character of Punchline, like, just think about that, what that symbolizes. Like, he's the Joker, right? He tells the joke. She's one step beyond that. She's the Punchline. She's the payoff. She's... You know, we see that scene at the end where it's not like, here's the Joker and here's his sidekick, Harley Quinn. It's here's the Joker and here's this new character, Punchline, who aspires to be even greater than the Joker. So I do get what you're saying, and I agree with you to some extent of, you know, okay, if there's no Joker, there's no Punchline. And you very well may be right if she doesn't have that situation that happened to her in her formative years where she encountered the Joker. It doesn't spark that curiosity where she goes and, you know, starts doing research and like falls down the rabbit hole. But you wonder, right? I mean, and I don't think this has been fleshed out, and maybe it will be at some point, maybe not. But you wonder, for somebody to fall under the spell of that, you can look at it one of two ways. The Joker planted the seed by doing what he did, and it flowered into her eventually becoming Punchline. Or the seed was already there. There was already something inherently wrong with her. And it could be genetic. It could have been from some other trauma in her childhood. You know, we know some people are just born as, you know, psychopaths. They don't have the same sort of feelings, chemical imbalance in the brain or whatever. And so the Joker just sort of watered that, sort of triggered that seed that was already there. Just depends on, you know, what different writers want to do. So, you could go either way. It hasn't been established. So yeah, maybe it's the Joker's fault. Maybe not. Maybe she would have become a villain in some way on her own, even without that Joker influence. So I find that stuff to be interesting to think about. And the fact that she is so ambitious, she does have, you know, kind of this idea that she's going to be even greater than the Joker. I find all that to be interesting. What I don't find to be interesting is that she's sort of a female Joker in a way. And I don't care for that character. And so I don't care for this character because, like you said right now, whether some writer takes it, you know, beyond that and talks about how she would have become bad anyway or whatever, the bottom line is right now she's derivative of the Joker. I don't care about the Joker. I don't like the Joker. I don't care about Punchline. I don't like Punchline. I read it because new character, important character, and I wanted to check it out. Agree with you 100% on the whole social aspect of it and the fact that when you sit here and think about it, you write this comic in like 2008, write this comic in 1997, it would seem so far-fetched. Here's this sidekick of the Joker or partner of the Joker, however you want to label her, who took part in Joker War and who killed people and who ordered people killed and caused all kinds of destruction. And then gets caught and turns around and says, oh, no, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. I was the victim. I was brainwashed. I was whatever. it doesn't matter. Like in the court of law, that doesn't matter. Like,
no.
Did you do it or not? That's all that matters. The facts are what matter. And nowadays with social media and, you know, the truth being subjective, like I talked about before, all of a sudden, yeah, 2020, perfect time to write a story this way. Because yeah, you could totally see it happening. And the court of public opinion is something completely different from the court of law. So This is just a one shot. But I imagine with the popularity of Punchline, we're going to get an ongoing or at least a limited series. Will that be where we find out what happens in this trial? Maybe. Do I care? Kind of no, because we know that Punchline's not going to go off to prison for a bunch of years. She's going to be back in a Batman comic at some point in 2021, guaranteed, if not multiple Batman comics and multiple stories.
It does seem like something that'll continue in Detective. And I say that just because of like Bluebird.
Yeah.
Involvement. It's something that'll fall under those lines. And I think it's a smart move too, to put someone like Bluebird, maybe even a Batwoman in a book like this, because we've seen it before that Punchline versus Batman doesn't really work.
Yeah. And that's the other thing that we've talked about is after Joker War, with the way that it ended and Joker saying he was going to go away for a while, that we were going to get a break from the Joker. But if we don't get the Joker in 2021, but they just replace him with Punchline, in my mind, that's not a break from the Joker. Batman has so many other great villains. Can we just?
Yeah, the
God, man, I'm so tired of the Joker. And you know, Punchline to me, it's the same kind of character, crazy and the clown makeup and goofy and blah blah blah, and no actual physical powers. So how the hell are you going to stand up against Batman? Like. Yeah, give me the Mad Hatter, give me Maxi Zeus, give me Black Mask. Clayface is now a hero, so we can't get him. But we got a little bit of Two-Face recently. But man, there are so many other.
The Royal Flush Gang. I don't know.
Yeah, Royal Flush Gang, Calendar Man. Just somebody.
We haven't seen else. In a while.
The Penguin. Try something. Killer Croc. Scarecrow.
I'm still waiting for somebody to write just a beautiful Freeze story.
Yeah, Mr. Like so many great characters. And we did get some of them in Tom King's run, but they were cameos. It was all, Bane pulling the strings, and then it turned out it wasn't even Bane, but it was his father, which that's a whole entire of why that doesn't work.
And also don't use the Riddler because it's getting there too.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing about the Riddler, he's not a fun character anymore. They power leveled him up, and now he's one that you can't just bring in for like a three-issue fun kind of story, you know? So that's kind of disappointing as well. Maybe this Ghostmaker can be somebody, although that has a whole nother can of worms too. Like, wait. So just like the problem I had with the Court of Owls. Wait, so the secret, you're telling me that Batman's the second smartest person in the DC universe, but this Court of Owls has been operating in Gotham underneath his nose for all this time?
Mm-hmm.
No, that doesn't work for me. And now you're telling me, there's this guy who took all the same training as Bruce Wayne and is just as formidable as him, and Batman just let him be because he promised to stay out of Gotham? What? I don't think so. Yeah, Ghostmaker. He looks cool, but I'm not buying that. So anyway, yeah, I'm glad that I read the Punchline one shot because there are some interesting aspects of the character that I hadn't seen before. But at the same time, I finished reading it and it's like, man, when I read a comic, I want to feel entertained. And I don't want to be reminded of all the crap that's going on in the real world. But you read this book and you can't help but think about the crap that's going on in the real world.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. It's well done. Like, it's technically a well-written story. The art is great and really interesting ideas, but entertainment value on it is low for me. And again, maybe it's just because, the election just happened, and with the fallout of that, the truth is more subjective than ever, and it just, I don't know, maybe just bad timing. All right. Well, let me talk about my next to last book. It's Iron Man number 3 from writer Christopher Cantwell. Art is by Kafu, colors by Frank D'Armata, letters by Joe Caramagna. This is another one of those books this week where it's very much a setup, very much a transitional issue. We don't see a whole lot of action, but what we are getting is a real insight into how hard Tony is working to try to rediscover who he is. And this has been a theme throughout Christopher Cantwell's Iron Man so far, is Tony really trying to get back to his roots, really trying to understand who he is without all the trappings, without the, you know, billions of trillions of dollars of you know, resources. Who am I? Am I just a guy who wears an Iron Man suit? Am I actually Iron Man? You know, here he is. It's supposedly Tony Stark's, you know, original consciousness in this cloned body. So that's adding, you know, more insecurity to it. And with Christopher Cantwell's love of comics, he's bringing a classic villain back. We saw that in the first issue, that Korvac was going to come back. He kind of reveals himself to Tony here. And right at the end, and it's left on a little bit of a cliffhanger, and how Tony is going to, you know, combat somebody who almost single-handedly defeated the Avengers is going to be interesting to see as well. So like I said, kind of a setup issue. It's really putting right to the forefront in the story how much Tony is struggling with his identity and who he is, and sort of a reboot of the character. And I did see somebody on Twitter that was talking the other day, and I never, you know, condone this. I don't necessarily like every comic I read, which, you know, this episode's kind of a good example of that. But I never attack anybody because nobody sets out to make a bad comic. They're trying to do their best. But if you don't like something, that's fine. And you can even express your opinion online that, you know, you don't like something. But you should never attack somebody. And somebody online had said, and they, and this is the other thing, even if you're going to like really, you really dislike something and you're going to attack it, don't quote or don't tag the creator in it so you're sure that they see it. Like, if you want to vent, do it offline to your friends or whoever. But if you just must do it online, don't tag the creator so you're sure they'll see it. That's just bad form.
That's just rude.
Yeah, it's extremely rude. And so I saw somebody, and they tagged Christopher, and they said, "Man, Iron Man is so bad. Have you ever even read an Iron Man comic? This is so, terrible. This isn't even who Tony Stark is." And Christopher, to his credit, it's like, "Well, you know, I really enjoyed the Denny O'Neill run. Like, he didn't argue, or he didn't, you know."
Man, he actually answered? That's messed.
Yeah, he said, "You know, I really liked the Denny O'Neill run, and that run got much darker than anything we're planning to do. You know, it's about taking the character, you know, back to his roots." And what he's referring to there is Denny O'Neill did a run in the late 80s where Tony Stark had fallen off the wagon. He was drinking heavily again. He had lost Stark Industries to Obadiah Stane. He had come in and taken it over. And Tony was homeless and living on the streets and drinking. And it's one of my favorite covers. I think it's Iron Man 172, I want to say. And I think I've talked about this on the show before. And Tony is sitting in the snow in a suit, but no jacket. It's a blizzard. And he's just sitting there with a bottle and a brown paper bag in this blizzard, you know, freezing cold. And he's sitting in kind of this alley. And on the wall behind him in big letters, says, "In the morning, Tony Stark will either be sober or he will be dead." And it's kind of that story, that issue is kind of when Tony hits rock bottom. And then in subsequent issues, Denny O'Neill starts building him back up. That's sort of what Christopher is doing here. You know, that's Christopher, you know, read those stories in his formative years, and it really stuck with him. And, you know, I started reading the original Iron Man series with issue 152 and read it all the way up until I couldn't even tell you when I dropped off after the Heroes Return storyline at some point. But, you know, a good 10, 15 years of reading Iron Man. But I think what a lot of people look at, and they've read the recent Iron Man stuff, and it's all the recent Iron Man stuff, ever since 2008, when Robert Downey Jr. played the character, I'd say right about 2011 or so, 2012, I feel like something flipped in the comics, where all of a sudden I wasn't seeing Tony Stark in the Iron Man comics. I was seeing Robert Downey Jr., you know, with his one-liners and, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of snark, not Stark, but snark. And it was fine. It was entertaining. It was a different sort of take. But to me, that's not who Tony is. I'm over in the Christopher Cantwell camp where, you know, he's a much more serious character. He's got his flaws, and exploring those flaws along with his genius and along with the burdens that places on him. You know, here's a guy who may be, you know, one of the top three smartest guys in the Marvel Universe, top four. We got Reed Richards, Bruce Banner, Tony Stark, maybe put Dr. Doom in there as well. So he's got this genius level intellect, and yet he's always struggled with, you know, alcoholism and addiction in his mind, knowing, hey, I shouldn't be drinking. I can't drink. That's a Achilles heel for me. And one of the smartest guys on the planet, but he can't stay away. And at times he's, you know, fallen off the wagon, and it's caused him problems, and his ego has caused him problems. That's been more in the recent years, because that sort of fits in with the way Robert Downey Jr. portrayed him in the movies. But getting him back to those roots of, you know, here's a guy who's, you know, super, super smart and, you know, can build these incredible armor and weaponry, but he has his flaws, right? Like, in what way does that genius intellect isolate him? In what ways do his addictions prey on him? In what ways is his identity tied up in his money and his resources? In what way is his identity tied up in his actual intellect rather than his personality? You know, the emotional part of Tony, he's always been portrayed as a guy. And this is one part that they did the same in the movies as the comics. He's always been kind of a guy that always has a, you know, really hot girl on his arm, you know, hopping from one girl to another. And does he always need to be in a relationship? And these are the kind of things that Christopher Cantwell is exploring. He said in multiple interviews before the first issue came out, he certainly said it when he came on our show and talked about it, is he wanted to get back to the basics of the character. Like, you know, it's sort of like Batman that we've talked about before, where every comic creator has their Batman story. So when they get on the Batman book, they gotta, you know, top the previous guy. And what I love about this is Christopher's not trying to top anybody. He's actually dialing the character back. Like, he's peeling back all these extra things that have been added on over the years, right? Like, you know, a bigger and better armor, to the point where, was it Matt Fraction, I think, or Warren Ellis, that with the extremist armor, where the armor was actually inside Tony's body and he could just think about it and it would, you know, come out through his skin. Like, let's get rid of all that. Let's get back to the basis of the character. And Christopher is not just stripping all that away. He's doing it in the story. Tony himself is saying, I need to get back to basics. I need to find out who I am. I need to remember at my core what makes me heroic. Am I heroic, even, for that matter? And so I really love that Christopher is doing that. And I love that he's bringing back a classic, one of the most classic Marvel villains, Korvac, who hasn't been used in years. The Korvac saga, you know, in the Avengers was just mind-blowing at the time. So to bring Korvac back, having Tony at his, you know, hearkening back to an earlier version or who he is at his core, I think all that is great. So if that's not your cup of tea, because you're a huge Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man fan, then that's fine. There's plenty of those books out there that you can still read. Just don't read this, you know, because this is not for you. And when that person said that to Chris, I even came back and said a lot of what I'm saying here. Like, if you're a fan of the RDJ Iron Man, then this is not the book for you. This is taking Tony back to his roots, and it's very much who Iron Man is. So, you know, for that person to tag Christopher and say that, and to say you've never read an Iron Man comic, it's likely that Christopher has read a lot more Iron Man comics than you, because he's going back to the classic Iron Man era. I mean, to me, that era from like 150 to 250, maybe 275, that includes the Armor Wars story. That's really great. That includes maybe even go back further, maybe go 125, because then you get the first Demon in the Bottle series that Denny O'Neil did, and then you get the second time when he fell off the wagon, and then him building back up to that silver and red Centurion armor in issue 200. That is like the classic Iron Man era. And maybe it's just because, you know, that was when I was like in junior high and high school, and I just loved the books, the art. Bob Layton, David Michelinie wrote a lot of it. Mark Bright did a lot of the art along with Bob Layton. So yeah, it, really, really classic stuff. So I'm enjoying Iron Man. I think if you're not beholden to the RDJ version of Iron Man and think, okay, if Iron Man and Tony, if Tony Stark doesn't act like Robert Downey Jr., then it's not Iron Man. Then you're going to see who Tony Stark is at his core. And it's exciting. It's refreshing. It's something different, something that we haven't had in Iron Man in a long time. So I'm really enjoying it. And the art by Kafu is gorgeous. Like, the lines are a little finer than Kafu's art is previously, I feel. So it makes for a really clean style. And he's really giving us a lot of emotion in the faces, especially for Tony. You can see that uncertainty in his face. You can see that emotion in his face of him really questioning stuff. The action scenes are handled really well. Feels very kinetic. And you get Alex Ross covers. So there's a lot to like. The colors by Frank DiArmada are really great as well. So I think it's a really, really great return to the roots of Tony, and I have a feeling that this may go down as one of my favorite Iron Man runs in recent memory. So, and I know you're going to get caught up on it at some point, Manny. Don't fall too far behind, man. Only issue 3.
I know, man. It just feels like it was issue 1 just not so long ago, and here I am again, issue 3.
Well, that's the thing, though. Kafu uses quite a few big panels, so these are relatively quicker reads, and Christopher is not really wordy, so. You know, 3 issues probably take you maybe 45 minutes. You'd be all caught up. So. All right. Well, what do you have for your last book?
My last book is Dark Knight's Death Metal Infinite Hour Extreme, number 1. Or it's the one shot, but whatever. This book has 3 creative teams. The first one is Frank Thierry with art by Tyler Kirkman and colors by Arif Prianto. And then the second part is by Becky Cloonan with art by Rags Morales and colors by Andrew Dahlhaus. And then the third part is by Sam Humphries, pencils by Dennis Cowan, inked by Bill Sienkiewicz, colors by Chris Sotomayor.
Bill Sienkiewicz, the legendary Bill Sienkiewicz.
Bill Sienkiewicz. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, that's not how I would pronounce that, but I apologize. If you're a Lobo fan, this book is it for you. I thought it was fantastic, and for all the wrong reasons. We've been highly critical about death metal and how we're so sick and tired of seeing all the different Batman, because there's a dinosaur, there was a dark side, I think there was a whatever. Point is, we've seen it all, except in this issue we see the Batman who frags, which is a Batman who is a combination of course Batman and Lobo. Now, I think what makes this great is Tyler Kirkman's art, and you kind of combine it with Brianto's colors, makes these characters look fantastic. I specifically love kind of the full shot of him over the actual Lobo holding the chain. I mean, just huge, broody, muscular, just badass looking, well, Batman Who Frags. And then a little bit further in the design of his motorcycle, bat cycle thing that you can call, and the detail that it has to all of the homages to both Lobo and Batman, I thought was done really, really well. And then even at the bottom of that page, in the as it ends, kind of the silhouette that they decide to paint of it, I thought was just fantastic. Done very, very well. The whole premise of this entire book is the fact that Lex Luthor needs Lobo to get him the death metal. And we all know why, because the universe, multiverse, everything hangs in the balance. And I mean, just Lobo does it in the Lobo way. And it's actually split up into several parts. The first part is the Batman Who Frags, obviously, where he has an encounter with this character. And the second part is actually where he goes to find it. And that's called What the Frag Is Death Metal Anyway. And then the third part is Lobo Land. I don't, like, there's so much I want to talk about it, but I can't talk about it because then it ruins the whole book. And that was kind of the fun of it. What made it so fun. And so can't say too much more about it. The one thing I will say is that I was really into the Kirkman art. So then when we go to the Rag Morales' art in the second part, it kind of like took away from it for me, because it was so different that it kind of took me out of the story a little bit. Just because the styles are so different. And then going forward to the third part, say kind of the same thing, but overall, just because of the fact that it really gives you that Lobo that everybody knows and loves, just made the book really, really entertaining. And it kind of gave you that a little piece of death metal that I thought was, that who knows as it's going to continue on to the main series, but it's done in a very fun and entertaining way, something that I haven't necessarily felt too much in this event. So kudos to them, and I can't say more of it. There's other stuff I want to talk about it, but I can't, because it ruins the surprise of some of the damn things that this guy does.
Yeah, so I love what you said first when you were talking about it. If you like Lobo, you're going to love this issue.
Yeah.
That is 100% true. This is the Loboist of Loboist books ever. I am not a big fan of Lobo. I feel like, man, this is like the most negative episode for me. There's nothing that I really, that was just great, get super excited about. So that being said, even though I'm not a Lobo fan, this was entertaining. But I haven't read a Lobo book in quite a few years, probably 5 or 6, 7 years. And I've read this, and now I don't need to read another Lobo book for 5, 6, 7 years. Yeah, this is about all the Lobo I can take. But you're right. It was fun. It was over the top. It was, funny at times. First of all, so Frank Thierry, if you guys aren't aware, Lobo's like his favorite character. He loves Lobo. And so you get a character who's passionate about a creator who's passionate about a character, you can just tell he's putting his heart and soul into it. And so, Frank gives him the perfect voice with, the irreverence and whatever. And so, yeah, it was done really well. Fits into the whole over-the-top narrative of death metal. Yeah, I was reluctant to read it. I almost was like, I'm just going to skip it. But I was like, no, it's Frank writing Lobo. I know he's been waiting a long time to do this. So, let me at least read the first couple pages. And I got sucked in. I was like, okay, this is better than I expected. But yeah, like I said, I don't need to read any more Lobo for quite a while. But I have to say, I did think the same thing Manny did, that, man, if you're a fan of Lobo, then you're going to just eat this up with a spoon. It's going to be like, oh, that rocked. Because, yeah, between the fights and the blood and the motorcycles or space cycles, whatever you want to call them. And yeah, I think I know exactly what you're talking about, Manny, with what you want to say, you know, when he gets the death metal in his hands, what immediately happens after that, and then how that ties into the end. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, that's pretty cool. So, yeah, if you at all like Lobo, you're definitely going to love this issue. All right, well, let me get to my last book, and this is actually my book of the week. And what's so great about the fact that this is my book of the week, so I've talked about the previous two issues that I read from this writer, and the first one, I didn't say it was terrible, but it didn't feel like it was really clicking for me. And then the second issue, it got way better. And now here he is on his third issue, and it's my book of the week. So it's the latest issue of Flash, number 765, and it's from writer Kevin Shinnick. We have Sammy Basri and Will Conrad as the artist. Hi-Fi is handling the colors, and Steve Wands is handling the letters. So this is With This Ring, Part 3. And just like I said when I talked about Part 2, about how what I loved is Kevin is taking the cool things about Flash, and he's leveling them up. He's using Dr. Alchemy as the big bad here, but he's making him like more dangerous, and he's leveling him up in terms of power and making him a threat to Barry. So it feels like there's consequences. That's exactly what we were just talking about that we want to see over in Batman. Like, take some of these lesser known villains and modernize them and make them interesting. And that's exactly what Kevin has done. And it feels like classic Flash, and it feels like classic Barry Allen, where he's going up against a member of the Rogues. Now, I can't get into too much detail or any detail really about what he's done to Dr. Alchemy to make him more powerful, but it's something that makes complete sense. It's really clever, and it makes Dr. Alchemy a much bigger threat. And other writers, now that this has been established, what Kevin does here, other writers can now take that toy out of the toy box and use it. And maybe he will go up against his power level. He could go up against Superman now, certainly go up against Batman, Wonder Woman. So it's great. He's really graduated Dr. Alchemy as a villain in terms of his threat level. Also, the theme of, you know, it's called With This Ring. And the ring, the Flash ring, has been a theme in the first issue and in the second issue. So he's following through with that again, and he's using the ring as a part of the story that makes sense, and it keeps coming back to the same theme. So this is really, really strong writing, and I almost feel bad for, calling him out on that first issue, because while it was the weakest in context with these other two stories, he's pulling so much that you didn't realize was of consequence from that first issue, and he's weaving the threads through. So it's a really, really great. I'm at the point now, you know, I talked about when I read that first issue, who was going to be the next person on Flash, because we know that Joshua Williamson has left. We know in December, it's going to be the Eternal Winter storyline. And then in January and February, it's going to be the Future State crossover. We won't have any of the regular books. So the question is, who's writing Flash in March? And I have to say, based on the strength of issue two or part two of With This Ring, and now issue three of With This Ring, issue 764 and 765 of Flash, I hope it's Kevin Shinnick. If he can keep giving us these type of stories for Flash, then I 100% want to see him do a long run. And I think a lot of the people who talked about the fact that Joshua Williamson's run was boring or dragged on too long, or they didn't like the pacing, or they didn't like the feel or the tone, jump on this. This is a, you know, and I liked what Joshua did. I really did. But what Kevin has done so far has a completely different tone and feel. But it still feels like Barry. Joshua Williamson's run felt like Barry. But this does too, in kind of a more classic way. And so I think if you are a fan of Flash and you got tired or didn't like what Williamson was doing, jump back on. Jump back on, pick up the first couple parts of With This Ring, pick up this this week's issue of Flash, and I think you're really, really going to like it. The art has been great as well. Very primary colors, which sort of always suits a Flash book because it's Barry Allen and he's one of the more optimistic characters in the DCU. And the art has felt very classic, very clean lines, very super heroic. So it really suits those bright colors. And we're also getting a lot of cool scenes that are showcasing Barry's speed. Yeah, there's a sequence where he's fighting Dr. Alchemy that has a long panel that's really cool with Barry kind of flipping around in the air. And then we get some overhead shots of Barry running through the city where it's just this red, yellowish streak with lightning all around it. And so, yeah, really, really like the art in the issue. Really like the ideas that Kevin is presenting. And so, yeah, this and it's not just because some of the other books were kind of exploring themes and politics and stuff that I didn't enjoy that I picked this. I wanted to recognize what a great job Kevin's been doing, especially because I had some doubts after reading his first issue. But this was just a blast. This was just a blast to read. You know, not the only good comic I read this week by any stretch. But for me, of the books I talked about, this stood out. So are you going to give a shout out for any particular book for Book of the Week, Manny?
Book of the Week, hands down, American Vampire 1976, number 2.
Nice. All right, well, let me go ahead and give you guys a rundown on some of the other books you might want to be on the lookout for today. We have a new number 1 from Aftershock Comics called Miskatonic, number 1. It's not really sure what it's about. You can't really get that great of an idea from the solicit. It says, Miskatonic Valley holds many mysteries, cultists worshiping old gods, a doctor dead set on resurrecting the recently deceased, a house overrun by rats on the walls, but none more recent than a series of bombings targeting the valley's elite. These horrors reach a breaking point when the brilliant hard-nosed investigator Miranda Keller is sent to stop the bombings to J. Edgar Hoover. So obviously it's set in past times. I haven't read it yet. Not sure what it's about, but I wanted to mention it because it's Aftershock and their stuff tends to be really good. So that is out there on stands today as a new number 1 if you want to check it out. From AWA, we have the second issue of American Ronin. And if you're not familiar with American Ronin, it's, you know, in the future, there's no democracy. Everything is run by corporations, and the corporations have these, I don't even know what you'd call them, weapons, I guess, these enhanced humans that fight for them. And it kind of reminds me of Lazarus in that way, although that's not corporations, that's families that own businesses, and they have their Lazarus who, you know, fights for them. This is sort of the same thing, except it's corporations. So dystopian future, capitalism, run amok, that sort of thing. And I haven't read any AWA stuff, although I've been buying some of it because I've been hearing really good things, and they have some really great creators like J. Michael Straczynski and Mike Diodato. And I did buy Resistance, but I just haven't had a chance to read it. So I've been hearing good things about American Ronin as well. So you may want to pick up issue 2 and see if your comic shop has any copies of issue 1 left and grab that as well. From Boom Studios, we've got the new Power Rangers series starting from Ryan Parrott with Power Rangers number 1. We also have the next issue of Tom Taylor's 7 Secrets with number 4 and Al Ewing's We Only Find Them When They're Dead number 3 is also out there today. From DC, in addition to the books that we talked about, we've got Green Lantern season 2 number 9 from Grant Morrison and Liam Sharp. We've got the final issue of Hawkman from Robert Venditti with number 29, Superman number 27, over at Image, there's a Kick-Ass versus Hit-Girl number 1. From Marvel, in addition to the books that I already talked about, we've got Excalibur number 14, Marauders number 15, Marvel Zombies Resurrection comes to a conclusion with issue 4 of 4, latest issue of Star Wars Darth Vader with issue number 7, and we also have issue number 7 of Wolverine. Over at Valiant, we've got the latest issue of Rye from Dan Abnett as issue number 9 hits the shelves. So those are just a few of the other titles that you might want to be on the lookout for today. Definitely I don't want to say they gave us a week off, but considering the last like 3 weeks have been jam packed with tons and tons of books, I did feel like at least for the books I'm interested in reading, this was a somewhat of a lighter week. So it was nice to kind of catch my breath and not have to read like, you know, 20 or 30 books over the weekend. I don't know. Did you kind of feel the same way, Manny?
No. Yeah. When it was like 6 o'clock and I was done reading, I was like, it's a light week.
Yeah. It's good to have that every once in a while, 'cause I'm still trying to get caught up on some other books. Have you been reading any older stuff, or have you just been trying to get caught up on newer stuff?
I've been trying to get through the Long Halloween.
Gotcha.
And then I get stuck reading current stuff, but I think I'm halfway through.
That's a good one. I've been reading Ex Machina from Brian K. Vaughan, him of Saga fame. So I actually bought on eBay the whole series, and it's a TV show or a TV show or a movie. I think you're going to be doing a movie. Yeah, a movie with Oscar Isaac, who's also been rumored to be in the running to play Mark Spector, Moon Knight.
Hey, I'm all good. I'm good with that.
Yeah, I think it's a good choice as well. What's interesting though is, so Oscar Isaac was already in a movie called Ex Machina, which doesn't have anything to do with the comic. Completely different story, different concept, everything. And so I think when they're, and it's still in development, I don't even know if they have a script written yet, but if this Ex Machina comic book story does come to the big screen, they're going to call it The Great Machine, because the main character in Ex Machina, his alter ego, his superhero identity, is the Great Machine. And so, yeah, I've never read it. I've always heard really good things. And it's funny. It's funny. I talk about not wanting to read comics about politics or whatever. The guy is the mayor, if you're not familiar. He's the mayor of New York City in the book. So he gained these powers to be able to talk and communicate with machines. And he lived in New York City his whole life. His name is Mitchell 100. And he put together this suit. He's the only person in the world that has powers when it starts out. And then there's hints of other people that maybe have some powers. And he starts trying to help, but he's kind of bumbling. And, you know, it's tries to be more realistic. Like when you're flying and you know, because he can talk to machines, and he was an engineer before that, he builds himself a jetpack. But just because you're smart and you can talk to machines and you built yourself a jetpack doesn't mean it's easy to catch a person that's trying to commit suicide by jumping off a building, because they weigh a lot and he doesn't have like superhuman strength or anything. So Brian K. Vaughan does keep it kind of realistic like that. So at some point, Mitchell 100 decides, you know, I would be better off helping the city by becoming mayor. And he decides to run for mayor, and he gives up being the Great Machine. And then one of the planes hits the first tower of the World Trade Center, because the series came out, I think, in like 2003, 2004. So, you know, right after, a few years after the 9/11 disaster. And so like the first plane hits the first tower, Mitchell throws on his jetpack, comes out of retirement, so to speak, and is able to save the second tower by diverting the plane, the second plane. And then his identity is revealed. And that's that popularity and him saving the second tower is kind of what gets him elected. But it's a very political book, because the guy's the damn mayor of New York City. But here's the difference of why I can read that as opposed to all the politics. This is politics in 2004, 2005. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, there was a lot of divisiveness and rhetoric then, but it's nothing like we have today. So it's not the whole left-right thing is not, it's not really present. At least it hasn't been so far. I think I'm in issue like 30, and I think there's, I want to say 60 or 70 issues. So I'm not quite halfway, but.
Well, the whole left-right thing didn't really happen until post 2016. And that's really when the
great well, that's when it got, happened. Well, we could, yeah. Welcome to the politics podcast. But yeah, I mean, there's arguments about when it's leveled up at various times.
Yeah.
But yeah, 2016 did take it up to another level. So, but yeah, that's what I've been reading along with some actually on my iPad that I have my comics on. I've got a couple of the essential editions. So it's got a bunch of classic Spider-Man, like from Amazing Spider-Man number one. And I've also got Iron Man from the very beginning and Captain America from the very beginning and Hulk from the very beginning. Because these are some series that I've been putting together during the pandemic. Like I've been buying on eBay big lots of classic Bronze Age, classic Marvel characters. So I'm like, man, it's been a long time since I've read Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man from like issue one forward. And I don't know that I've ever read Hulk from issue 102 was when Hulk started. Same thing with Captain America 100 to 200. I don't think I've ever read those. Iron Man, I've read all of it, but it's been a long time since Iron Man 1 to whatever. So, but when will I have time to read all that stuff? I don't know.
It's That's on what I was going to say. I was like, yeah, I hope you can fit in classic reading with the new reading.
Yeah, I can't even get caught up on, yeah, I still haven't read any of the deceased stuff.
Have you read Strange Adventures yet?
Nope. Exactly. First issue only of Strange Adventures. Yeah, I mean, the last issue of Hawkman came out today, and I couldn't read it.
That's because, you know, that's what I was going to ask you. I was, like, very surprised that you did not cover the last issue of Hawkman.
I was planning on it, actually. I was like, oh, man, it's coming out today. I need to read some Hawkman this week, last weekend. I was on call, and it was too busy. I didn't get a chance to read it. I was going to try to read some today, and I was working at the day job all day, and I didn't get a chance. I was like, man, how many issues of Hawkman can I read in, like, 8 hours? I don't know. Let's find out. And then I didn't even get a chance to read any of it.
God damn.
The other thing that's coming to a close really soon, and I've only read like the first 22 or 23 issues, is Gideon Falls.
Oh, I'm caught up with that. I'm very happy to say that.
Yeah, there's issue. What I think it's ending with like 33 or something. What's the last issue? I think it comes out next week. But yeah, that's another one where I'm like, man, I need to. And the problem is, it's been so long since I've read it that now I kind of need to go back and read it from
kind of do because it gets really wonky.
So the last issue I read was when he first went to the other dimension.
Oh yeah, I don't know. So the last issue is issue 27, and just in case you need a little bit more time, it's an 80-page book.
The last issue is an 80-page book?
Yeah.
So 28 is the last issue?
27.
27. Okay, so there's 26 out. So I'm not that – so I think I must have read up to like 15 or so.
So I'm not wow, that. You're farther behind than I thought.
But I'm not as far behind as I I'm not sure.
It's wonky, man.
I know. So hopefully – I mean, I plan on – I
can't tell you what happens to the pastor.
when does it come out? So it's not next week, so I have a little time. I probably shouldn't have looked it up. I probably, because now it's like, oh, I have time.
It's in December. I should have just looked it up.
It's not till December 23rd.
Oh, you got some time.
Don't see, that's a thing. Tell me that. And I,
comes out next week, Jace.
Yeah, that's what I. So yeah, issue 27, the end. Can't wait for that TV show too. Really excited about that. So, all right. Well, I definitely need to get this episode edited and up. So, any last thoughts, Manny?
Not really. Just real quick. Just real curious about the direction that DC is going to go in after
Future State.
Yeah. I mean. I kind of like the route that detective is going, and maybe even Batman. But the guy I'm really worried about is Big Blue, Superman. Just get him the right creative team again, because during Rebirth, Superman and Action Comics was one of those books that could really take me away from the day to day, the real world, and just have a good, solid Superman story. It kind of that. So when you were talking about that earlier, it's like, man, I just want a book to, you know, just kind of distract me for a while. That's what that was, you know, that real American family, in their own way, of course, with Lois and Jonathan, and Clark, obviously, and kind of, and then intertwining it again with Batman. It was what they did with Catwoman and stuff. And that was that was so good. So well done. I just kind of wish they get back to something like that with some of these characters.
Yeah, well, I think the only thing we know for sure, and you know, technically we don't even know this for sure, but it's pretty strongly hinted at, and you kind of read between the lines, is they're going to be less focused on continuity and, you know, stories tying in with each other. It's going to be more about just let the creative team tell the story they want to tell. And if Superman's in space in this book, it doesn't matter that he's, you know, in a different dimension in Justice League. Like, whatever. They don't care. So if that's the case and it leads to great stories, I'm fine with that. But, I mean, DC is so much more so than Marvel. It's so much rooted in the history and the continuity. And the DC fans seem to care about that a lot more. I was just talking about how, if you look at the Marvel Universe right now with this whole outlawed storyline that's going on with the teen heroes, you wouldn't know it reading a lot of the other books. DC is much less like that. So you're much more likely to see things tied together, because that seems to be what DC fans like.
I felt that they did a good job with the Green Lantern books, even with Morrison and with Liam and things like that, where it was kind of its own thing. And I really dug that book.
Yeah, but you're not seeing Hal Jordan in any he's not even probably, in Death Metal. They just put John Stewart and Guy Gardner and Jessica Cruz and Simon Bat.
You just spoiled it. Hal Jordan's about to come back with all the rings.
Maybe so. So anyway, yeah, I'm very curious as well. We'll know a lot more come December, when we get the solicits for the January books, creative teams are going to be in and all that. So anyway, that's a discussion for another day. So once again, we want to thank everybody for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.